Chapter 17. Changing the Culture of Deception. When George W. Bush arrived at the White House, I believed he offered a real opportunity to move beyond the hyperpartisanship and excessive politicking that have come to characterize Washington. But it was not to be. The permanent campaign approach we publicly denounced and distanced ourselves from in the 2000 campaign was vigorously embraced after Election Day. The massive Bush campaign machine was integrally woven into his White House governance without adequate controls or corresponding checks and balances. Ultimately, that machine worked not only to spin the media and defeat our opponents, but to spin and defeat ourselves. Imitation, they say, is the sincerest form of flattery. If so, members of the Clinton administration should feel deeply flattered when they look at the Bush administration. In our own way, we built on the art form the Clinton White House established and took it to a higher level. It worked well in a number of ways for Bush, as it had for Clinton. Bush was able to pass historic education reform, reduce taxes, implement important new measures to strengthen homeland security, including some that were controversial, give all seniors prescription drug coverage under Medicare, expand trade, and mount unprecedented efforts to combat debilitating disease in Africa, all in addition to notable successes in the war on terror abroad. You may agree with some of these policies and disagree with others, but there's no denying that Bush's presidency has been enormously consequential. Its influence on the course of history is still unfolding and will continue to do so for years to come. In this sense, Bush is a president who achieved a tremendous political impact, for good or ill. It's another demonstration of the short-term power of the permanent campaign. But if President Bush and his team had recognized and understood the many pitfalls of the permanent campaign approach to governance, the administration as well as the nation would have been better served. Our excessive embrace of the permanent campaign philosophy had the greatest consequences for the presidency of George W. Bush when it came to Iraq. No single decision caused the wheels to come off the Bush White House, but the way we went about executing the decision to go to war, from making the case to the public, to inadequately planning and preparing for its aftermath as we rushed into it, sent us badly off track. Selling war through a political marketing campaign, rather than openly and forthrightly discussing the possible need for war with the American people, is fraught with danger. Today, we are seeing its destructive results play out. Washington is as polarized as ever, and Congress and the White House remain unable to come together for the good of the nation and our troops to forge a consensus way forward and bring the Iraq War to an acceptable, successful conclusion. The president is seen as once seemingly untouchable credibility. His honesty and trustworthiness plummet, leaving questions of deliberate deception lingering in the public discourse. I still like and admire George W. Bush. I consider him a fundamentally decent person, and I do not believe he or his White House deliberately or consciously sought to deceive the American people. But he and his advisors confused the propaganda campaign with the high level of candor and honesty so fundamentally needed to build and then sustain public support during a time of war. Had a high level of openness and forthrightness been embraced from the outset of his administration, I believe President Bush's public standing would be stronger today. His approval ratings have remained at historic lows for so long because both qualities have been lacking to this day. In this regard, he was terribly ill-served by his top advisors, especially those involved directly in national security. All the president can do today is hope that his vision of Iraq will ultimately come true, putting the Middle East on a new path and vindicating his decision to go to war. I would welcome such a development as good for America, good for Iraq, and good for the world. Bush knows that posterity has a way of rewarding success over candor and honesty, but as history moves to render its judgment in the coming years and decades, we can't gloss over the hard truths this book has sought to address and the lessons we can learn from understanding them better. Allowing the permanent campaign culture to remain in control may not take us into another unnecessary war, but it will continue to limit the opportunity for careful deliberation, bipartisan compromise, and meaningful solutions to the major problems all Americans want to see solved. I've tried to avoid becoming embroiled in the question of who started the partisan warfare and who is most responsible for the current culture of deception in Washington. It would take an entire book even to attempt to answer the question. My guess is that an objective, nonpartisan look at the facts would conclude that there is plenty of blame and responsibility to share, from presidents of both parties, to Democratic and Republican leaders of Congress, from partisan pundits and interest group leaders, to the complicit enablers in the Washington and national media. Let the one who is without sin cast the first stone. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to find anyone who has lived in this destructive world of Washington, a world that has grown detached from the problems and priorities the American people care most about, who is truly without sin. This is the reason so many Americans, especially those in the broad majority at the center, feel disenchanted and even disgusted with politics. And this is why we urgently need to get beyond blame and recrimination and focus instead on cleaning up the system. The good news is that a desire to see that happen is real and growing across the country. Is it possible to divorce campaigning from governing? Should it be a crime to try to manipulate the sources of public approval for governing as the permanent campaign requires? I don't think so. That would be a dangerous road to travel. Our political leaders must be aware of popular opinion, and to govern effectively, they need to appeal for the citizens' support. In this sense, campaigning and governing do go hand in hand, and pretending otherwise would be folly. Fraud and deliberate deception, of course, are another matter. So is the misuse of government offices and funds for purely partisan purposes. These are crimes, and they should be. If there is hard evidence of anyone in government crossing the line of legality, then he or she must be held to account. But to try to define the modus operandi of establishment Washington as inherently scandalous misses the mark and allows the root problems to continue unabated. Unfortunately, elected leaders of both parties are having it both ways. They condemn the permanent campaign rhetorically, even as they embrace its most destructive and inherently deceptive tactics. The excesses of the permanent campaign need to be addressed and ended. They are deeply destructive to our national political discourse, and the consequences are all too real in terms of both policy and politics. To criticize the system is not to excuse or absolve elected leaders of either party for the decisions, tactics, and means they have embraced that contribute to the destructive excesses of the permanent campaign. The vast majority are good people, but they were elected to lead, unite, compromise, and put our nation's best interest above that of their party. Too few have stepped forward to lead us beyond the partisan excesses. President Bush is paying a heavy price for his failure to do so. His public standing has been severely diminished as a result. But simply pointing the finger at one person obscures the bigger problems that need addressing and correcting. Our elected leaders must begin the process of change by ending their inside-the-box mindset of doing what everyone else does. They are in the best position to alter the status quo, and no one can do more than the president. No one has as loud a microphone or as prominent a stage as the president, and the primary responsibility for initiating change rests with him or her. Note, for the rest of this chapter, I'll refer to the leaders of tomorrow simply as he, to avoid the awkwardness of saying he or she repeatedly. No disrespect is intended to any current or future national leaders of the female gender. End note. The president could exercise an immediate positive impact on the culture in Washington by taking some key steps that do not require an act of Congress. Not that these steps would be easy to accomplish and sustain. They require constant awareness of the excesses of the permanent campaign, of the long-term dangers of engaging in politics as war, and of the need to deprive the scandal culture of its lifeblood, including internal inaction, secretiveness, stonewalling, obfuscation, and dissembling. Presidential candidates could start by informing themselves about the perils of the permanent campaign, not just in terms of current political tactics, but in the broader context of American history and its evolution over generations. Reading The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, the book edited by Norman J. Ornstein and Thomas E. Mann that I referenced in an earlier chapter, would enlighten many. seeking wise counsel on how to deal with the problems of the permanent campaign from scholars who have studied it should be an early step as well. As I witnessed with President Bush, it is not enough to preach unity and pledge to change the tone. Most Americans are ready for both, but rhetoric is meaningless without concrete steps. What institutional changes would a potential president make to counter and minimize the damaging aspects of the permanent campaign? In what ways would the potential president make bipartisan deliberation and compromise central to governing, something that is constantly and integrally embraced? It will not be an easy task to overcome the excesses of the permanent campaign. A president must have a specific plan that can reassure the public his commitment to reform amounts to more than empty words. A president-elect should insist that those overseeing his transition into office learn about the permanent campaign, what it is, how it works, and the consequences of embracing it. A president-elect should also insist that his senior staff heed the same lessons. This could enable new administrations to avoid some of the pitfalls the Bush administration fell into, such as taking a massive campaign apparatus into the governing structure of the White House, a particularly dangerous mistake when there is no strong counterbalancing force in place. Once in office, the president must demonstrate an unyielding commitment to three important principles. 1, a high level of openness, forthrightness, and honesty when communicating with the American people. 2, a spirit of inclusiveness and unity which reaches across partisan divisions and ideological differences to encourage cooperation among all groups and individuals. And 3, a readiness to consistently govern toward the center, seeking common ground from which to solve problems rather than appealing to a narrow base of opinion.